Mike Fortune Wood, please. Thank you.
Put it on. Okay. Hello. My voice is a bit strange at the moment. I'm afraid I'm not very clever. I haven't got overhead projectors or anything like that. I was just talking from script. So if you'll bear with me. The approach of this talk is going to be rather different to everybody else's in that it's not about individual families or the way autonomous education works. I'm going to be talking about things in the aggregate. I'm trained as a social scientist and an economist. So I tend to think in aggregates, in big numbers, in lots of people and trends, and also in about politics. And one of the biggest lessons that many of you will learn as you sort of move through and you've been home educating for many years is that education and parenting is a political issue. Whether you like it or not, you might not like it, but it is. There's a famous quote that goes that education is a weapon and its effects dependent upon who you aim it at. Can anybody tell me who said that? Does anybody know? It was Stalin. I could have picked any one of a number of people who said something very similar. There's quotes from American policymakers and educationalists, people like the Rothschild family and so on. They all had input to American education policy right throughout the 19th and early 20th century. And they all said things about controlling populations and the content and nature of education. And of course, education started, the education that the system as we know it in the West began in Prussia as a result of a failed military defense of Prussia against the French. The Prussians, being highly militaristic, really didn't like the idea that the French could possibly defeat them in battle. It was just like, how could that happen? And the conclusion they came to was very similar to the one that we came to following the Boer War. When a bunch of farmers trounced the British army in the first half of the Boer War. And Kipling wrote a lot about it. We developed the scouts. In 1815, the German-Prussians developed the mass education system that all our schools follow today. There's an American writer called Gatto who writes a lot about this. And I think it's Dumbing Down. Dumbing Us Down. There's a whole history of how this developed, if anybody's interested. Yes?
Underground History of American Education by John Gatto.
That's the one, yeah.
It's free off his website.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that, actually. But there you go, free. Excellent. But it's an important lesson for us to learn. What we do as individuals at home is highly political. It's very much like the feminist argument that the personal is the political, or I think that's the way it went. In fact, I'm going to be drawing on the feminist movement later on, and perhaps the question you might want to bear in mind is, how did we get from a point where the feminist movement quite rightly demanded equal access and opportunity to the workplace? How did we get from that, which was a legitimate demand, to the point where we now have single parents, women, sending their children into enforced childcare, which is substandard, and being forced to take low-paid, dead-end, pointless, meaningless jobs and earning very little more than they would have been getting on benefits, and perhaps paying, or the state, somebody paying as much for the state to look up for the childcare to happen as these young mothers are earning themselves anyway. How do we get from the demand for the rights to the point of compulsory nature of employment for young women in work? And I think that same thing could be happening, or has the potential to happen, with education, with home education. Now, I'm going to you'd have to bear with me, because it's going to look like I'm arguing against children's rights. I'm not. I'm actually arguing against or wanting to present the issue that children's rights are a tool of government. They're not about children, or at least they're not being used for children. They're being used to further government policy. And I'm afraid this is where I'm going to stop ad-libbing, and I'm going to actually draw from this text that I've got written down. It lasts about 20 minutes, so there should be a good gap at the end to discuss things, but if people want to interrupt and they don't like what I'm saying, that's fine. But it seems a bit like a crazy thing to come into a group of home educators, autonomous home educators at that, and say children's rights are a bad idea. Because it's counterintuitive. But I think my argument holds true, and I'm not the only one who holds it. Those of you who know me well will know my feelings on HSLDA. It's an American homeschool legal defense organization. They're a fundamentalist Christian group, and my argument is that I don't believe they're actually about homeschool. I think they're actually working on a different agenda. But the very one thing that I agree with them wholeheartedly on, for slightly different reasons, is that the children's rights movement, or the children's rights policies that are being adopted by government, is not about children's rights. It's actually about government control. They come at it from a different perspective to me, but it's the same position. So I'm going to read through this thing. If you want to interrupt me, you can try, but there'll be plenty of time at the end to ask questions. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Great. Okay. If, like me, you welcome the development of children's rights, you may also have been surprised to realise how these rights have become tools not to free children and families, but to control them. The state is focusing ever more on families, like home educators who make independent-minded decisions. Children's rights are being used by governments as a tool to control children and families' parenting styles in an attempt to homogenise children's life experiences, in the misbegotten notion that childhood can be thought of as a factory process leading to the adult end, to the adult as an end product. The further away we from the current fashions of parenting that we structure our families, the more we find ourselves the focus of state interest. While children's rights are expressed in documents like the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, are reasonable and fair of themselves, the state's rhetoric on children's rights serves to manipulate these principles into tools that drive wedges between parents and their children. While the state has rightly become parent of last resort, involving itself only if and when absent dysfunctional families fail to protect and care for their children, over the last few years, this relationship has gradually changed to where the state now second-guesses decisions made by families, in effect micromanaging those families and the children's lives. And this led to the Children's Commissioner, Maggie Atkinson. Do you know, have you come across Maggie Atkinson? Yeah. I don't know what your feelings about her is, but she gave a talk on YouTube for a while before she was Children's Commissioner. She was head of Children's Services in Gateshead. And she gave this talk and she listed children, different categories, like children in care, children in school, children who use youth clubs, children. And she listed dozens of, it goes on for quite a long while, and it's basically virtually every possible child. I mean, I couldn't imagine a child not being into one of these categories or more of them. And then she said, they're mine. I don't know, but it really disturbed me. These developments are not restricted to the UK alone. The USA, Australia, Canada, New Zealand are all guilty of state trespass into the private lives of families. In the UK, this is called Every Child Matters. In the United States, it's No Child Left Behind. If you actually read the No Child Left Behind policy, it's horrific. Some of the things in it, several pages which enforces the American school boards, which are like our local education authorities, to send, they have to give the the military, they have to give the military access to the child's email and personal address details so that the military can email the children directly and present them with promotional materials for joining the army. It's part of the act. Local school boards have gone to court. There are some states where they've tried to refuse to hand this data over, and the military have gone all the way to the Supreme Court to make sure that they still get access to this. This isn't secret. This isn't just me talking. This is, if you look on the internet, yes?
Right, I just want to add, in support of what you're saying, there's a school in Peterborough, which was three high schools closed down, replaced by a super academy, the largest in Britain.
Yes.
And on its fabulous building, £15 million, a sliding roof, Apple computers. Never mind PCs, but Apple computers. And no playground. So the children can spend all their time in the building in lessons.
Yeah.
And on the grounds is an army cadet building.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, that same building, it's actually modelled on the old mass jails. It's the same style as the... there used to be a jail in Westminster that was enormous. It was absolutely... It got a name, a
Panopticon.
The idea was you could be seen, you're never invisible. And this school was based on the same principle. If you actually look at the two plans, the layouts of these two buildings, which you can see on the internet, there's copy, you know, there's plans of, it's not there anymore, but you can see the layout.
Yes,
it's very similar.
I've been to this school, I've been around this. They have all the classrooms have windows. They don't have walls.
No.
So it's glasses. There's a big atrium in the middle. And then the classes go off it. I walk into the foyer, and it's very well done. I thought I was like walking into a hotel, and there's a couple of police officers. And I asked the receptionist, what are they doing here? So no, they've got an office here.
Actually, having police in schools isn't uncommon now, even in Britain. It's not as uncommon as it used to be. My ex-wife used to work in a school in Bristol even 25 years ago that had a police officer in the school. Mine, to be fair, it was the same school that caused the St Paul's riots, so maybe that was some justification for it. The thing is, the governments link their own targets for children to so-called welfare categories. By sleight of hand, the governments have turned government targets into rights, rights into welfare concerns, and welfare concerns into child protection cases. It's a direct link. A child's failure to meet a government target is translated into the language of child abuse, with parents labelled as culprits. Parents are effectively locked in to the state aspirations for their children and may no longer bring up their own children in their own way. Instead, they must either follow government directives on parenting, regardless of their child's individual needs, or risk the stigma of being labelled neglected or neglectful and suffer the indignity and trauma of state intervention. What's this led to, in fact, is that people are now starting to talk in terms of what's called defensive practice. It was a term that was originally used for doctors. When doctors make a critical decision about a patient's treatment, they'll think about several issues, and one of the issues is what happens if it goes wrong? What happens next? You know, what sort of decisions do I need to make to ensure that I'm not going to end up in court? Or if I do end up in court, then I'm going to be able to defend my actions. This means that you end up with what an economist would call a suboptimal result, that the doctor isn't just thinking about the clinical best practice for the patient, he's thinking about his own career, and it's understandable that he does that. We've got the same thing among parents. I mean, parents used to do lots of things that would allow their children to do lots of things which are more adventurous, a little more risky than they would do nowadays, I think. And I'm not entirely convinced that the reasoning that parents use when making those decisions isn't just entirely about the child's safety, it's about how it would look. How it would look to the papers if the newspapers printed the story, how it would look to the social workers when they come knocking on the door if little Jimmy ends up with a broken leg because he's fallen out of a tree for the third time. You know, why do you allow your children to climb trees kind of question? You know, how do you justify that? Where am I? sorry. The state proactively protects children's rights against their parents. On the face of this sounds reasonable, but it means that the state takes over ever more intrusive powers, not only to protect children from real known harm, but to investigate and prevent theoretical possibilities of harm. The degree of intrusion is now so damaging to the parent-child relationship that it is itself abusive, I think. Such policies de-skill parents who become ever more reliant upon the state to provide for their children. Parents now expect the state to take care of functions such as education, health, sex education and childcare that were not too long ago the sole remit of parents. Sex education is a real issue in point, but I'll come to that later. State-sponsored preschool for up to 10 hours a day at the age of one is common in most parts of Europe, such as the Netherlands, for example. The Netherlands, it's almost the norm. It's almost aberrant now to not have your child in some kind of daycare from the age of one onwards. Sweden is now considering compulsory childcare for children over the age of three. In the UK, preschool is effectively mandatory for those wanting access to high-demand schools, where preference is given to those children attending their preschool classes. What's happening is, to get funding, a primary school will set up a preschool section. We'll put one of these little porta cabins in the playground, fence it off, and call it a preschool. We'll put a couple of, whether they're teachers or nursery nurses or something, we'll put them in there. But then, to make sure that they fill it up, because they only get funded if it's full, they give preference to these children that are in this preschool into their induction class, their first year class. So effectively, if the preschool again reaches the point where it's as big as the first year induction class, you can only get into the school at all if you send your child to the preschool. So it's effectively, I would argue, making preschool compulsory, and that happens in a lot of places. And it's particularly true where the school is popular. I mean, you can easily have a situation in a smaller town especially where there might be three, maybe four infant schools. If two of them are particularly good schools and they're running these preschools, you've got to get your child into the preschool. So you've got to be effectively preschooling your children from the age of three. Even worse, by promoting children's rights as something that is at odds with parents' rights, the state has removed access to the information required by parents to parents effectively. In the UK, the single largest category of children placed into care is that of emotional abuse. Now, a lot of home educators know about this, because this is what we get accused of when we home educate, because it's the socialisation issue is often regarded by many social workers as emotional abuse. We're home educating, they're not going to school. They must therefore be socially isolated, therefore they're being emotionally abused. You're isolating your kids on purpose. And for home educators, this can entail alleged failure to socialise. Over the recent years, home education campaigners have noticed an increasing trend in the UK for education authorities to report families to social services on the ground that the family is socially isolated, for no other reason than the fact that the child does not go to school. From a definition of abuse on a UK government document, emotional abuse includes, and this is a direct quote from a government website, I've got the address of the website if anybody wants to check, it's overprotection and limitation of exploration and learning, or preventing the child participating in normal social interaction. That's abusive. Now, hand on heart, how many home educators, particularly with younger children, if you're living in a smaller community, not, say, in a big city like London or Birmingham, can you honestly say that your children is mixing with as many children as the child might be mixing with if you were in school? I mean, it's questionable whether that's necessary, and that's what I would question, but that's the basis on which emotional abuse and neglect is being measured. A parent can lose custody if their child is overweight, and yet cannot by right access their children's medical records, or their educational records for that matter, on the grounds that the child has the right of privacy. Similarly, the first a parent may know that a child is having a termination of pregnancy is when the school nurse phones to say their child is in hospital due to a bungled operation. the school nurse can arrange for a termination of the child's pregnancy. I don't know whether you realise that, and they have no obligation to tell you. It's not uncommon. I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon. If a young girl goes to the school nurse and says, I'm pregnant, I'm frightened what my parents are going to say, and the nurse will say that I can arrange a termination, but we should tell your parents. If the child says, I don't want my parents to know, those parents won't be told. It'll all be arranged through the school. And the termination will happen. The child will go in. It's only an hour or two's operation. And will come home from school in exactly the same way. You will never know unless the child tells you. Some countries take this even further by making psychological testing of children a legal requirement. Texas legislature recently discussed such a law, and other US states have imposed curfews on children during the school week. The thing about psychological testing is that Texas were looking at the idea that everybody, all children in the state, should be psychologically tested. There should be an assessment form. In Britain, we have the CAF, what's it called? CAFCAS forms, the assessment. It's not really a proper psychological assessment, a test in the strictest sense, but it kind of borders on it. There are elements of psychological testing involved in that, but it's not testing assessment anyway. Curfews. Several US states have imposed curfews on children during the school week, which have affected home-educated families and children. Similar laws were proposed in the UK in 2009, though they were aimed at excluded children, but they would have affected home educators because they effectively made it impossible for children to be out and about during school week. I certainly wouldn't argue against children having rights to make decisions about their own health and education, but the state isn't removing so-called overprotective parents to allow children freedom, but rather so that the state itself can be the major influence on the child. It's all in the name of children's rights that Badman wanted the LA officials to be able to demand to see children without the parents there to ensure that the child is happy and wouldn't rather be in school. Of course, no one proposes to ask school children if they want to be home educated and then force the parents to do it. I've actually done that, not actually spoken to the kids, but I used to train local education authority EWOs and EHE advisors. And I used to frequently get them saying, oh, we need to see the child, because I was telling them, you don't have a right to see the child. And they would say, we need to see the child because we need to know that they're happy being home educated. And I said, okay, you can come and talk to my kids about being home educated, but I want to be able to access one of your senior schools. I want to be there at the assembly and be able to propose home education, tell them it's a legal right, explain to them that their parents can home educate on demand. I'll hand out some leaflets and I'll speak to any of the kids after the assembly. It didn't go down terribly well. They thought I was joking. I have actually also said there was another LEA that was trying to do the same thing, and I threatened to organise a group of parents to stand outside one of their schools handing out leaflets on home education. They didn't like that very much, and I believe they did inform the school that they thought was most likely, and there was some real concerns and discussions about the police being called. I don't know what they would have done to stop us. I mean, it's just bizarre. I mean, we would never have done it. It wasn't the point. But they just don't see that there's, you know, if you're talking about children's rights and access to information, then it's got to cut both ways. Otherwise, it's partial. But they don't see that. It clearly identifies that they think of home education as aberrant. You know, we are aberrant. We're strange. Our children need protecting. You know, it's not that children have rights and need to have their rights protected per se. It's that they need protecting against weird parents, and we're weird. The medicalization of normal childhood behavior offers the state further opportunities to intervene in the family. In the UK, the Department of Health says that there are 400,000 children with ADHD alone. That's 4% of school kids. Now, I don't know if anybody could possibly believe that even could be vaguely true, but that's what they say. Another 500,000, that's about 5%, are said to suffer from school phobia. I've actually written a book on school phobia, and it's actually staggering. How it's all measured. There are now schools in the UK with more children registered as having a special need than children that don't. You know, there are schools with more than 50% of the kids with a statement. The full list of pseudo-psychological conditions they can draw upon is practically limitless. My personal favourite is called OD. Does anybody know what OD is? Oppositional disorder. Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? I don't want to do that. Oh, you've got a psychological illness. I'd have been in a loony bin years ago. My whole life has been OD. Any inconvenient behaviour can attract a label. Subsequent medical treatment. And woe betide any parent who refuses the treatment for their child. The state has effectively medicalised resistance to policy. I mean, the question I ask on here is, am I the only person to have read Solzhenitsyn? You know, I can't believe I'm the only person in the West still alive who's read Cancer Ward and so on. You know, it's frightening what's going on, and it's being done to our children. You know, they're being controlled. They're being controlled. Education is a political tool. The medical treatment, the medicalization of disorders, of opposition, actually, is really a big one, particularly with school refusal, I think. I'm convinced that in most cases, school refusal isn't about school phobia or a medical condition. I don't think these children have what's called SAD. I mean, school phobia is no longer an illness of itself. It's what's called a diagnostic criteria of another illness. It's basically a symptom. And it's a symptom of SAD, which is social anxiety disorder. So what they're saying is these children are socially anxious, and one of the ways this is manifest is by them refusing to go to school. But what I think is that, well, it's actually certainly the case that if these children are taken out of school, their so-called social anxiety disappears. If you home educate most school phobic kids, if you home educate them, they're no longer anxious about anything, and they socially mix without a problem. It's just school they've got a problem with. But it kind of brings me to the conclusion that what's actually going on is it's about what I call convenient and inconvenient behaviour. That school phobia is inconvenient. You know, it's inconvenient for children not to go to school. That leaves a school with two possibilities. You can either, well, three, I suppose. You can say, okay, don't have to go to school. Well, that's not going to happen. Or they could punish the child, and that's what they pretty much do. But there comes a point where the child's opposition to going to school is so intense, the punishment would have to be so equally intense, and they're unable to really deliver that. So, because of children's rights, you know, they're kind of caught on their own petard. So the way they get around it is by medicalising it, because if you medicalise something, you can do anything to them. You know, you can tie a person up. If you say it's a medical treatment, you know, you can tie them up and treat them with psychological drugs. You can do anything you want. So by medicalising school refusal, they then drug the kids quite often. They can drag them into school. I mean, I've had parents write to me and they're saying that they were advocating. I literally dragged my child physically out of the car by, you know, his legs if need be, and drag him into the school gate where he would be, you know, frog marched into the lessons by two big male teachers. You know, usually the sports teachers dragged out for the job, and the EWL be involved. I mean, it has happened. And that's justified. I mean, it wouldn't be justified if it was the child that was just objecting, but if the child's psychologically ill and is no longer capable of making good decisions on his own behalf, you can do that. Any inconvenient behaviour can attract a label and be subsequent medical treatment. To understand what's happening, we need to understand why governments would put so much energy into intervening in children's lives. After all, it's incredibly expensive. The UK alone employs 30,000 children's social workers. That's about one social worker for every 300 children. Nearly twice as many social workers than general practice doctors throughout the population as a whole. And this doesn't include the armies of education and child psychologists and education welfare officers and EHE advisors. You know, there's thousands and thousands of people involved in this as an industry. It's costing them a fortune. It must be a very, very expensive operation. Many of these programs are driven forward by seminars run by the World Bank. Now, this is going to sound like conspiracy theory, so I've actually written it down here. That if you go into the World Bank website, or if you go into Google and you type in "No Child Left Behind," and you put that in quotation marks, and then you put in another set of quotation marks, "World Bank," that ensures that it keeps those two phrases together but separate from each other, you know? You'll get a whole lot of websites, World Bank's own websites, where they're running these seminars. Governments are becoming ever more involved in children's lives for two related reasons. Firstly, the burgeoning economic pressures faced by Europe, particularly in the United States, as our technological advantage is eroded by the new superpowers of China, India, Brazil, and Indonesia to an extent. European governments think that Europe is in danger of major long-term relative economic decline, and these emerging super economies as they develop. Western nations have concluded that Europe's future is dependent upon a highly educated and motivated workforce. They see this as achievable by ensuring that all young people receive an education suitable to the needs of modern high-tech corporate industries. Governments are today involved in a race to get as many young people into university as possible in a bid to maintain the technology gap. We've all seen this. If you look at the media, one of the things they constantly talk about is the proportion of young people getting into university. Greenland, for example, have something like 95% of their young women are all at university. Australia is boasting something that's not far off. Australia, young women in Australia, nearly all of them go to university. And we're heading up to 40-50%. When I left school, it was around 4 or 5%, maybe 3%. Within about 10 years of that, it was up to around 10 or 15%. We're now hovering around 40-45%. They're aiming at 50% within the next 5 or 6 years, and eventually they want 2/3 or better. The government is becoming... home educating parents are not trusted to produce sufficiently honed units of production targeted to the perceived needs of corporate industry. Despite evidence to the contrary, European bureaucracies believe that home educated young children will either grow up to be dependent upon the state and fail to contribute to society's economic well-being, or perhaps even worse, grow up to be overly critical, unwilling to be readily slotted into this dumbed-down mechanistic concept of education. They're also fearful that home education will continue to contribute to social division, because parents may not pass on the ideas of multiculturalism to their children. I think that's actually wrong. I don't know many, many parents who are passing on something that wouldn't fit within a multicultural model. But it's certainly one of the issues that they've raised. But if they're right, that economic decline is likely, then such social division could produce an unstable mix, contributing to explosive unrest throughout Europe. Now, the Germans have a term for this. It translates as parallel societies. And it's the main reason why the German authorities are refusing to allow home education in Germany. It's why home education in Germany is illegal, because they're frightened about parallel societies. Which it basically means different worldviews. I mean, that's all it is, really. Yes?
Is it true that Hitler was the one who banned
homeschooling? Yes, it is, to a point. He formalised the law in 1931 that banned home education and forced them to school, but it did actually exist. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, the lady asked, Nina asked, whether it was true that Hitler had banned home education in Germany, and it's true. Yeah, in 1931 he formulated the law that prevented it, but there had been laws before that which made it rather difficult and restricted the way in which home education could occur. It was basically you had to be fairly rich. Hitler's law made it just totally impossible, regardless of who you were or what you were doing. Everybody now in Germany receives an identical education, virtually. There are no alternative educational models at all, except for Steiner. There are Steiner schools, and there are very special reasons why Steiner is allowed in Germany. Why? Oh, well, it's historic. After the war, they brought in a lot of rules about it, but Steiner education was very well embedded in German culture, and when they tried to ban it, it just proved really difficult. There were just a lot of political difficulties involved in that, so it was never really gotten rid of, and so it grew again, and so these schools still exist. So it kind of occurred as a parallel thing. But because Steiner education is very German anyway, and it's culturally very German if you read the literature, it was still acceptable to do that, whereas none of the other forms, and there were many other forms of private education in Germany up to then. I mean, the interesting thing that I note is that they say, well, it's egalitarian to send everybody to the same state schools. You know, everybody should receive the same education, so all the kids start off from the same perspective. And they talk about home education as being undemocratic, which I find fascinating. When I was first, I had an argument. I was on the World Service giving an interview, and there was a German professor of education. She kept saying it was undemocratic to home educate. I couldn't get my mind around that at all, because it's not the way we use the word democratic. What she meant was it's anti-egalitarian. You know, basically what she was admitting was that home educated kids do rather well, and therefore they shouldn't be able to do that. I know. It kind of leaves you speechless, really, doesn't it? But that's the German viewpoint on the issue. I mean, what I might say is that, you know, it's as though homogenous society has served Germany so well in the past. You know, I was awfully tempted to say that in the interview, but I thought it might not go down too well for the German population, you know, the German audience. Since it was the World Service, if it was Radio 4, I might have said that. But World Service might not have been a good idea. I'm trying to win these people round to a degree, accusing them all of being fascists. Probably not clever. The Badman Review. Does everybody know what the Badman Review was? Does anybody not know what the Badman Review is? Do you want me to explain? Okay. 2009, home education in Britain faced its biggest challenge. The government instituted a review by a guy called Graham Badman, who ostensibly spent 9 months, I think it was, something like that, a year, going around the country consulting with home educators on what changes and what new regulations and what new rules that we should have. After which he ignored everything he'd been told and just went out and basically tried to wreck home education. Bowles, who was the education secretary at the time, clearly didn't like us. And it was all done for children's rights. It was, you know, children's rights needed protecting, children needed protecting. And it was said to be to do with Keir Ashak case in Birmingham, was the justification. But the main justification was that there was, I think it was a Home Office, there was a select committee that's linked to the Home Office, had a report on children being forced into marriage, you know, young Asian families being forced into, girls being forced into marriages abroad. And a barrister working for the CPS proposed the idea that it could be that home education is being used as a way of hiding kids who are being then sent abroad and married off in Pakistan or India. And it wasn't like he said, I mean, if he'd said, we have 5 cases on our books or 20 cases on our books of young people who've been, been home educated and taken off, I could, you know, okay, you've got these cases, you know, put your hand up to that. But he didn't, he just said it could be. And there weren't any cases. We issued FOIs to him, to the Home Office, to Foreign Office, anybody we could think of. Home educators, a group of home educators must have sent off 30 or 40 FOIs to different government departments, and not one of them could come up with a case, including the CPS. We sent one to the CPS asking them if they had evidence of any cases that had been brought, whether the child had been home educated and then forcibly married, and they didn't have any.
Did they get back to you, or did they say they didn't have any?
Well, they have to get back to you. Yeah, with an FOI, they can't they can't not. Certainly not if you're going to follow it up. So they do get back to you and say, you know, we don't. They come up with all sorts of phrases. They don't like to say no. You know, they like to say, you know, not at present or not as far as we can find, or, you know, we don't have the documentation or whatever. You know, but essentially it's no. But none of those who raised the issue were ever able to produce or name one child or bring forward one adult who even had any evidence. I mean, they didn't even have anecdotal evidence. There weren't even members of the Asian community who could come forward and say, well, I heard of a girl down the street who didn't go to school and she kind of disappeared and we all assumed she'd go off to... I mean, they didn't even have anything on that level. There was nothing. It just didn't happen. And after all, why would it? Why would you home educate and then send your child away? What you do is, like, the way it happens is that you wait till the school holidays and the child goes away and then just doesn't come back the following year. And when anybody asks, to say, oh, she's going to live in India or whatever. You know, she's moved with relatives or something. I mean, the child's left the country. Lots of children leave the country. Paula Rothmull did some research on it saying that the government have lost the records of up to 120,000 kids. The government don't know where they are. And that's because there's a lot of structural problems with the statistics. I mean, it could be that there aren't 120,000 children, but certainly the numbers don't add up. If you look at the number of children in school at any one time, and you look at the number of children there are in the country according to the census, there's a difference in the order of 120,000. Well, where are they? They could not be in the country. They might not be in the country. That's certainly the case. They might just have been moving in or out. They might be between schools. I mean, there's a lot of people just move house, and there's a period between them leaving one school and starting the other. So there'll be what's called structural transition or something like that. But certainly, there's a lot of children out there that the government aren't particularly sure about where they are. To go chasing after home educators seems like a hell of a lot of money to spend on chasing a small number of people. But you know, it's there's plenty of kids within the school system, so to speak, you know, that they don't know about. The mechanism the government used to control families is that they can justify making all kinds of demand on families, such as access to the child, so as to ensure that these special children's rights, looking back to the children's rights agenda, are protected by demanding that the education industry takes over ever wider control over the aspects of children's lives, while at the same time citing the child's privacy in refusing to consult or inform parents on medical and social issues that the children face. Parents are neatly marginalised and replaced by social workers. Now you don't have to think very hard to see how that happens. You know, if parents don't have the information, if they don't have access to the data, you don't have access to the decision-making processes because you can be bypassed by the social workers and the school nurses and heaven knows who else, then parents don't know what's going on with their children's lives. They're no longer part of the loop. And decisions end up being made by effectively people who are state workers. The state workers are working to state agenda and policy. They're working to policy documents set by the local authority and by a national government. Effectively, what you have is the state making decisions on as parents. It's kind of, we've drifted into this in the last 15 to 20 years. Recently, the home education community had to fight NICE off. Does everybody know who NICE is? I've got to try and remember what the initial stands for. It's
National Institute for Clinical Excellence.
That's right, National Institute for Clinical Excellence. Thank you. I keep forgetting. I write these things down, you know, and I know at the time what they are. They set medical policy against local health authorities have got to work to. So, for example, if there's a new drug, they license it. They allow it to be used and say how it should be used and when it should be used. They also set, on some cases where there are particular diseases where there's one particular treatment which is clearly and you know, really clearly better than all other treatments, they will say that if somebody has this, then this is how they must be treated. But NICE attempted to force home educators into a certain brand of age-based sex education for their children, because as they put it, it was their human right. NICE disregarded the parents' view of what was appropriate for their child, and even refused to consult or take evidence from parents or parental groups during consultations. I wrote to NICE several times trying to get them to take evidence from me, or to allow me to meet with them, or to have any kind of dialogue at all, and they just, first of all, they refused to reply to my emails, and then said it was inappropriate, or you know, just put me off. They just wouldn't have anything to do with it. They wouldn't talk to education otherwise, and they wouldn't talk to solicitors either. I had a legally trained person who tried to write to them, and they just wouldn't have anything to do with it at all, because normally they only deal with institutions. They don't deal with individuals, and therefore they were able to say we weren't part of their thing. But the fact was that they were dealing, they were trying to put controls on not what institutions would do, but what parents would do. Now, it wouldn't have had any legal power of itself, but it would have had persuasive power within a court should a home-educated child come up with a case involving a home-educated child if the parents weren't then following the NICE recommendations. You know, so you can see how that would go. The social worker's giving evidence about a case that they want, you know, they say, I don't know, it's emotional abuse again. And they would bring up the fact that the parents weren't following, a recommended policy that was felt by the health medical professionals represented by NICE. And the parents weren't doing that. And that would be evidence of neglect. In the end, it didn't happen. We managed to get so many people to write to them, so many objections, and so many people pointing out to them that you can't make us do this, that they I'm pretty certain they dropped the case. So they moved on to other things and just talked about what schools should do. It's also being claimed by many local education authorities, such as Birmingham, which in response to a recent review of home education stated that it was impossible for home-educated children to be safe at home unless they were monitored by the authorities. Now, it wasn't just that they weren't likely to be safe or they couldn't know whether they were safe. It was actually impossible for them to be safe. They couldn't be safe. Your children are not safe unless the education authorities are looking over your shoulder. Birmingham went on to create a home education policy that insisted on access to all children, threatening those who refused with police intervention. What they were doing was they were saying, if you home educate, we're going to review your home education regularly, and we'll come to your door, and we want access to the kids, and we want to see the kids alone. And if you refuse, we'll come back with a social worker and the police, and we'll take the kids away, and we'll interview them in a safe place. That was what was, I mean, we had to get a barrister in to deal with that one, and it was a fun meeting. They'd written out Section 47 of the Children Act, and they'd missed out five words. It was basically, Section 47 says that the social workers can insist on access to the child where there is evidence of immediate and serious significant harm. Evidence of immediate significant harm. And what they'd done was they'd missed out the five words at the end. So that what it read in their policy was the education authorities can insist on access to the child. Full stop. Missing out the condition. And so the barrister, the guy called Ian Doughty, who's a well-known home educating campaigner, and he's a home educator himself, he had the 2002 Act, and he had Birmingham policy, and he read out Birmingham's policy, and he read out the 2002 Act, and he said, I think your typist made an error, because you've missed these five words off the end. Look, and it kind of changes it a bit, don't you think? They didn't like that, but it was a fun hour to see them torn to shreds, really. While parents are denied access to information the state holds on their children, the state has open access to all children's data from whatever source. By law, doctors in the UK must hand over to social workers any medical data that might impinge on the child's life. So if you get involved in some kind of a protection case, you know, if the social services decide that your children are at some kind of risk, then they can go to the GP and demand to see the child's medical records. They can also demand to see your medical records. What they're looking for is any psychological illness. So if you've ever gone to the doctor and said you're depressed, or you're stressed, or you've had, I don't know, anger management problems, or your husband has anger management problems, or your wife has, you know, a relative, anybody in the house, or even one of your other children, you know, you've got another child who's been in trouble with the police. All of that data can be collected by the social workers.
Without your knowledge,
yeah. They don't have to come to you and say, can we do this? They can just do it. I mean, they sometimes do come and ask permission, but you don't have to, yes.
Sorry, Mike, just a slight qualifier, because that's something that I've done.
Yeah.
It's properly done. It is, I request information from the GP on any medical information that may have a child protection bearing.
Yes.
So if a parent's had some kind of physical injury, I don't have a right to know that.
No.
It's only if it's a child protection bearing. And then I trust that the GP makes the decision.
Sure.
On what that is.
Sure. But that can actually be quite all-pervading, can't it? So if for example the parent has cancer, that could have an implication
and then,
on
the. And then where it's measured, is to do with other factors,
yes.
Like co-factors that come into account,
yes.
Not on its own.
No.
And then you made mention of emotional abuse and social isolation. So I've actually dealt with a woman who was alleging that she was home educating her children, and what she actually was doing was isolating them socially. She actually was, because they weren't allowed outside.
At all.
When I was 16 years old, he didn't know how to cross the road.
Yeah.
I know the difference between home education.
Yes, and that's kind of legitimate, but the problem is that it's being used in some authorities just because they're home educating. Birmingham is saying there are boroughs around. Dorset, for example, is saying, and York is saying that a child is necessarily socially isolated because of home education.
Yeah, I think my interpretation of my reading of Education Law and the Children's Act. Mm. And the Children's Act, I think, is a fine piece of legislation in many respects.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that education in and of itself is a cause of
No, it doesn't. No. And neither does the CME guidance, statutory guidance. That doesn't either. But that's how it's being used by some LEAs. It's not the law of itself that's the issue, because they wouldn't be able to get these things past Parliament, really. But what they're doing is they're using what they have as a tool to kind of draw the wool over magistrates' eyes when they're looking at trying to get court orders for access to children.
Yes.
And most magistrates only know what they're being told on the door, as it were. So they're allowing access, and they're allowing these things to go through, and social workers then come knocking on your door demanding access. Yeah, but that's...
But it's
a dodgy thing to do.
It is. You've got to be really, really careful with social work.
Yeah. Oh, right. I'm running out of time. I'm going to quickly run through the last page. Is that okay with people? And then I can... At least I've read what I said I was going to say. Right, I've done that bit. It's families whose journeys through life deviate from the norm, as do home educating families, and particularly, I would say, autonomous home educating families, that are most at risk. Bureaucracy is most threatened by those who are least willing to engage with it and refuse to be easily pigeonholed, which is almost a textbook definition of autonomous home educator. Our children often redefine success and live to a different beat, and we as home educating parents most often reject government help even when offered. This makes us a problem to families. Living in this way cannot be expected to naturally work to government targets. Worse, they still have a minimal contact with the government agencies, and we offer them, the state, few routes into the family which can be used to influence the child. This raises alarm bells for those who are responsible for executing government policy. Our children are often only rarely seen by anybody in a position of recognised authority. The state, therefore, has very little data on them and what they are doing and how the education is proceeding, what they are being taught, to what degree they are integrated into society. Indeed, It's the very fact that local authorities hold so little data on these children will of itself suggest to them that home-educated children are not well integrated into society. It's because of this that they oppose home education in the wild, unencumbered by government targets and directives. And it's in this area that we see the greatest opposition. Calls for monitoring, where home education already exists, will become more vocal. Attempts to locate and prevent state-free home education will grow. And where they can't find, where they find they cannot do this, they'll attempt to regularise home education so as to better monitor. Monitoring will inevitably lead to the application of targets against which they can be measured success. And as currently is being discussed in Wales, by bringing us into the regulatory systems, they'll attempt to bring us out of the wild and into captivity. Mr. Badman famously pointed out to a group of home educators in Birmingham during his consultation, being left alone is not an option. Thank you.